now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone, it's Stephen Jones from the Sunday Times with a special edition of The Ruck, and it's a serious tone. Last weekend, World Rugby ran a Keep Rugby Clean campaign, warning players about the dangers of taking performance-enhancing substances. Rugby says that it is still reasonably clean, but is that true? Last week, athletics was back in the mire when Alberto Salazar, the great marathon runner and former coach to Mo Farah, was banned for 4 years. Is rugby as clean as we think? Well, my friend and colleague David Walsh has a sense of these things as sharp as anyone in the world. Luckily, David is only 2 floors down in the same Tokyo hotel. And I spoke to David about his career, Lance Armstrong, Alberto Salazar, and whether he thinks rugby is as clean as a whistle. David Walsh is our chief sports writer, famous for what I consider to be not only one of the most famous sports investigative stories, but in my opinion, one of the investigative stories of all time. It exposed Lance Armstrong, a winner of 7 Tour de France, as a drug cheat, and a really reprehensible drug cheat at that. And after one of the greatest and most tenacious investigations, he was exposed, and there's a book and a film about the whole story. The book, 7 Deadly Sins, Sparing David's Blushes, is not only the best account of it, but one of the finest sports books written. It's interesting to hear David's views because rugby, in my opinion, would be very susceptible to drugs, cheats and people trying to build themselves up for the mass conflagration that rugby is at the moment. We'll come to that in a minute. David, at the other end of your career, scraping the barrel, I understand you've also ghosted Lawrence Dallaglio's columns. Which was the more difficult, exposing Armstrong or trying to make sense of Lawrence?
I did. I actually enjoyed working with Lawrence. We had a lot of fun doing that book, It's in the Blood. Because, to be fair to Lawrence, he'd had a pretty interesting life. He was pretty forthcoming about it. And, no, I enjoyed it. It was a bit of a journey for Lawrence, that book, and I spent a lot of time down in his house. But I think at the end, we produced a book that it sold a hell of a lot of copies, Lawrence's book did. And, I mean, in a way, he was my employer. He was paying me to do it, and I would have to say that I found him an extremely generous employer. And that really does, you know, it does count for a lot. Because whatever you say about Lawrence, without trying to be too complimentary, he was a big man physically, and he's a big man spiritually.
David, people don't realise this, but when you and I first met, and for a long time before that and after, rugby was your number one sport. You played it at home, and that was what you did.
Yes, it was, yeah. When I started out as a young journalist in Dublin back in 1980, I mean, I quickly became a rugby correspondent. I was a rugby correspondent for the Sunday Tribune. I was rugby correspondent. I did a hell of a lot of rugby. You know, I met you, Steve, first at the 1987 World Cup final, or, well, at the 1987 World Cup, which was the first. And I actually sat beside you for the Wales All Blacks semi-final. And remember you saying to me that you loved it when New Zealand got a penalty. You loved it because that consumed 2 minutes of the match. And it was 2 minutes in which the All Blacks couldn't score a try.
Yeah, I wanted them to kick to touch so they couldn't score a try and then take a shot.
Yeah.
No. That's how it felt. That's really how it felt.
Yeah, but I did cover a lot of rugby in those days. And then I kind of, in a way, drifted into being a general sports writer, because I was always interested in other sports.
But you actually got an incredible facility to be an expert in a lot of sports. I mean, if I said to you the unfair question, because you love your racing, you love your cycling, you love your football, which is still your best, your most beloved sport?
I stopped thinking like that a long time ago, because what I realised was that when I was at Cheltenham for the start of the festival, it was Tuesday, and you had that roar at Prestbury Park as the tape went up for the first runners. There's a big roar. There's always a thought in my head, this is where I most want to be, you know, in life, at this moment, nowhere else in the world. But I feel the same when Ireland play England at Twickenham. I actually feel the same if I go to a really good Premier League game and there's a sense of anticipation in the ground. I used to love going to the old White Hart Lane, I would have to say. I thought that was the most atmospheric stadium in the Premier League. And when the match is about to start, you think, oh God, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. So I go to the Masters now most years. And when you're there, you think, this is it. This is the number one. So really what it is big events. I mean, when there's going to be, hopefully, World Cup semi-finals involving, hopefully, Ireland or England or Wales, and when they're playing one of the Southern Hemisphere teams in a World Cup semi-final, that's the place you want to be on that particular day. So it's not a question of a favourite sport, but it's loving being at those big occasions.
That's a great answer, which I share with you. I've not been to remotely the number of big occasions, but I find myself thinking, blimey, rugby was always number one for me, but you see all these other great sports, and it's difficult for me to think that myself in a way. Can I just ask you, you unlike some of the other dukes of the greats of newspapers, you've been here since day one at the World Cup. A bizarre and a lovely experience for me. What have you thought of the World Cup to date, on and off the field?
Yeah, I do have some context here, because I've covered every World Cup there's ever been in rugby. And in my view, this is the best. And I would say the best by some distance. The organisation has been amazing. The stadia have been fantastic. And how that translates into a great World Cup is that this World Cup has made every game feel a little bit special. I have to admit, I do not like watching a rugby match where one team scores 8 tries and the other team scores none. Or the other, one team scores 11 tries, as the All Blacks did last night, and the other team doesn't score any. But yet, you know, even those kind of games at this World Cup have had something. I mean, we watched the All Blacks, you know, and their 11th try is the one we're all talking about. And it's not like Namibia rolled over and allowed him that try, because I would argue the Namibian fly half's attempt to stop that try was one of the great cover tackles. Perfectly executed with tremendous commitment and technical proficiency, and Parinara still got the ball down. I mean, but that's why I think this World Cup has been on a different level to all the others, that every game has seemed like a big occasion. There's been no empty spaces in the crowds, and there's been no stadia that didn't look up to the standard of a World Cup venue. They've all looked good, and being on the ground and getting to the stadia here, the organisation has been terrific. I mean, I remember for the going to the Ireland-Scotland game and walking out of Yokohama Station, and of course, as a pressman, I would see it like this, but media shuttle here, somebody with a sign standing in exactly the right place, guiding you to the media shuttle. Now, it's only 3/4 of a mile, but they take you from there down to the press entrance. And that kind of organisation has been on a different level, in my view, to the organisation for every previous World Cup.
And there is a culture clash here, because they don't do things remotely like we do on some occasions. It's quite interesting when the cultures do clash. For instance, 11 p.m. at night, you don't have drinking up time, you're shoved out. But that's yes. Just a small thing, of course.
Yes,
but,
it is.
The culture clash, now and again there's aggravations, but is that all part of the fascination?
Part of the fascination. I mean, what you say is absolutely right. They kick you out of the press room at, I don't know, for 4 hours after the match. Now, if Japan had beaten Ireland, I was at that game. And the Japanese journalists, there are rows of them. I mean, I've never seen so many rugby writers from one country in a press room as Japanese rugby writers were in that press room. Mm. And they're all pleading with it's a woman who's running the centre, the media centre. They're pleading with her to stay. And she's saying no. But the way we do it in this country is if we say we're going to close at 9 o'clock at night, we close. Mm. So they all get turfed out. And I'm walking back to the station, because this match was in Shizuoka. I'm walking back to the station and I see all the Japanese journalists sitting under bits of light, sitting on bits of grass. There's actually fantastic artistic monuments that were built, works of art, I think 16 of them, that were built on the way from the station to the ground for the 2002 Football World Cup. And there are guys sitting on those works of art with their laptops open, doing their reports on their, you know, connected to the internet by their telephones. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like now 10:30 at night. It's pitch dark. I had this kind of, I looked at them and literally their fingers are dancing on their keyboards. And I thought it was the most beautiful thing. And you could see they felt they were reporting on a story. They were writing a story they would remember for a long, long time. And so even though they were kicked out, it gave me a memory I will have for a long time, the way they found every place they could sit to work. They just sat and worked. And of course, with the climate over here, you could do that 10:30 at night and not freeze.
Would the fact that you've only got 4 hours in the press room to write your stuff, wouldn't that impact on your normal operation speed?
Yes, it would, yeah. When it comes to producing stories after a game, I'm probably the slowest.
There's Nick Kane.
Yeah, but I'm up there. I'm definitely a contender. It would. And 4 hours should be plenty. But, you know, when you give certain journalists 4 hours, they take 4 hours and 15 minutes. You give them 6 hours, they take 6 hours and a half.
Of course we do. Of course we do. David, you spent a long time, books, interviews, a tour of theatres, etc., talking about Armstrong, and it's almost like asking Jeff Hurst about his hat trick. You must have discussed it millions of times, but where does it sit now in your head when you look back at all those things, the things that affected your life and your family, the abuse you suffered from Armstrong and other people who wanted to believe in him as a cancer survivor, or also wanted to believe in his cycling? Where does it sit in your head now? Because you should be feeling the most unbelievably deep feeling of satisfaction that you opened the book and you shut the book as well.
When I look back on it, I think that was a great time. God, I love that. And people say, but come on, it must have been tough for you and your family because you were being got at all the time. You were being called a liar. You were being called this. You were being called that. It never bothered me. It really didn't. I was kind of on a bit of a crusade, and I loved it. I loved the fact that, you know, I've got a new lead about Armstrong. I've heard that so-and-so said something in New Zealand. Stephen Swart. How can I get down to New Zealand to talk to him? And it just was all-consuming, and it was really exciting. And the way I like it, when people say, yeah, but it must have been tough. Now, this is a much smaller version. It's not on the scale of Watergate. But if you look at the film, All the President's Men, and you see Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, you know, on the case of Richard Nixon, trying to get the information that would bring down the president, they're not like going home to their wives or going home and saying how worried they are about this. They're actually more motivated than they've ever been in their lives. I got invited to France to do a talk somewhere. And it was Italy, actually. And the fellow speaker at this dinner was Carl Bernstein, who obviously was the Watergate journalist. And I met him and I said, look, I've always felt that you guys, yourself and Woodward, were having the time of your lives during Watergate. And because I felt similarly about, he knew about Armstrong, all of that. And he said, absolutely. He said, we knew at that time there was never going to be another Nixon in our lives. And I knew at that time there was never going to be another Armstrong. And I was always conscious, whatever happened, my career as a journalist would always be associated with Armstrong. And I do say, I mean, obviously I knew, and people you knew, Steve, because from all the conversations we would have had at that time, everybody who was close to me knew that Armstrong was a fraud. But if it hadn't actually been publicly acknowledged that he was a fraud, if he didn't actually admit it himself in the end, it would have been a less satisfying experience for me, I suppose. But at the same time, I knew if I was on my rocking chair at the age of 88 and I had a great-grandson who came to me and said, great-grandpa, were you once a journalist? And I would have said, yes, I was. And if he'd said, did you do anything exciting? And I'm left, and I've only got one word left to say. I would have said Armstrong.
But talking about comparison with Bernstein, they never actually, until the time of Deep Throat, got one massive, great chunk of evidence. That weren't they doing the same as you, just casting around for everybody, yeah, flying down to far Florida to see someone?
That's right.
Knocking on someone's door. It's almost like you start from the bottom and work up. You don't get some great, a massive sensation at the top of the story.
No, you don't. I remember the first real breakthrough I got in Armstrong. This came like 2001, 2 years after I started. The first big breakthrough was I had a friend, Sandro Donati, still a friend of mine in Italy. He was involved with doping investigations. He'd helped the police. And I said, Sandro, I think Armstrong is working with this doping doctor, Michele Ferrari. Mm. I said, I know you've got friends in the police. Is there any way we could check it up? And Sandra said, well, I'll ask the police, could they check it up, the Carabinieri. The Carabinieri said, well, if Armstrong has gone to Michele Ferrari's town, Ferrara, he will have booked into the two best hotels. And the cops sent two local DCs, two local coppers, to the two best hotels, and they said, show us your register. And they got the register of guests for the previous 2 years, and Armstrong's name was all over it. The cops got them to do a photocopy of Armstrong's name and the nights he stayed. And those A4 pages came in a fax to me, and seeing those coming out of the fax machine, the name of the hotel, Armstrong's name, we were like, that's it, we've cracked it. We were only about 12 years away from crashing, but it seemed at the time...
That was the first crack.
Yeah, it seemed at the time that this was it. Yeah. You know, I could now prove he worked with the doping doctor.
Yeah.
Story over. And all Lance had to say was, I believe Michele is an honest man. And everybody believed Lance, and I was a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, that's called... I think that's called journalism of the highest order, David. It's a restless business, because as recently as this Sunday in our paper... You commented, or you carried on the story of Alberto Salazar, the great athlete and the great coach, part of the Nike project, which involves a huge number of big athletes, banned for 4 years. And you wrote about the implications of this odd man who gave people prescription drugs when they didn't have prescriptions, who tried to sort of almost come up with different drugs by combining them and measuring performance and all that sort of thing, and then eventually has been banged to rights. The first question is, was that always a target which you thought would end as it has?
I didn't think they would, that the United States Anti-Doping Agency would get Salazar as well as they've got him. I think it was a brilliant investigation. I think Travis Tiger, the head of United States Anti-Doping Agency, is the guy really who nailed Armstrong in the end. He's now nailed Salazar. And I think something we should consider here, this is an American anti-doping agency knocking American heroes.
Mm.
If Alberto Salazar was this brilliant coach in Britain or in Ireland, would we bring him down?
Mm.
If Lance Armstrong had been British and he'd won 7 Tour de Frances, or had been Irish and won 7 Tour de Frances, would he have been brought down by people in his own country? I don't think so. Now, what Salazar was doing was very organised cheating. And the way he cheated was, basically, he was looking for legal drugs to use them in a way that were never intended. Mm. In other words, the thyroid drugs, which will, if you've got an underactive thyroid, you can take thyroxine or different brand name drugs to get your metabolism working quicker. That will help you to lose weight. Now, what happens if you go to Salazar and your thyroid is fine? It's not. He'll convince you, and his doctor will convince you that your thyroid isn't fine.
Yeah.
And you get the drug even though you don't need it. Now, that's cheating. And basically, the United States Anti-Doping Agency went after him. They got documents, and they organized a really good campaign in that they went after Salazar on the things they could get him on. There was loads of witnesses, and somebody made the point that Salazar has been got like Al Capone. He might have committed murders, but in the end, they get him for income tax irregularities. That's what they've done. They've got him on small stuff, but there was big stuff going on in the background. Now, it should be said, the Sunday Times Insight team did a really good investigation about L-carnitine, the supplement. That was the first crack. Mark Daly, Panorama, BBC, David Epstein, ProPublica, two outstanding journalists, took the case on and brought it seriously forward. The United States Anti-Doping Agency. See, that's what happens now. Mm. The journalists do the stories, and then the United States Anti-Doping Agency picks up the baton and says, look, the allegations in this story are too serious. We have to investigate. That's what happened with the great Russian conspiracy. Vitaly Stepanov, you know, works with the German journalist Hayo Seppelt, and the World Anti-Doping Agency moves in after that. And I think the point here, Steve, and I know you'll agree with this, is that good journalism is very expensive, but it's also very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've mentioned Salazar. I think, you know, journalism played a part in the Armstrong story. There's no question journalism has played a huge part in the exposure of the Russian conspiracy, all their doped athletes. So people should understand that, you know, they can go on social media and they can read everybody's opinion. But if you want to find out what's wrong in the world, well, that's where good journalists come in. I mean, out of this Salazar story now, Kate, my eldest, rang me last night and we were chatting. And she said, Dad, I read your Salazar story. You've got to go after Nike now. You know, they have a corporate responsibility to not cheat. That's what they tell their employees, that they're doing things in the right way, and they're not. They should not be allowed away with this. And that's what journalism can do. It can hold people to account. And thank God we still have it.
And thank God we still have it. And hopefully we'll keep it. Because for everyone from Marie Colvin to yourself and to all the whistleblowers and all the journalists, you have to be there and you have to be on top of it. You certainly couldn't do it from a room in your social media department. That's just one of my biases, but that's
no, I agree. I mean, I don't know if you've been reading all that Boris Johnson, Jennifer Arcuri stuff. I mean, it's been salacious, of course, but it's also been because it speaks to power and the abuse of power.
Yeah.
I think it's been terrific work by Sunday Times Insight
team. I'm really proud to be a Sunday Times a colleague of these guys and of yourself, because they're still keeping the old traditions alive, which is wonderful.
Tremendous,
which is wonderful.
Yeah.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One more question. From what I've learned about doping and cheating over the years from you and from everybody else, rugby would seem to be an ideal ground, because you need to train harder, you need to be bigger, you need to be harder, faster, you need to bounce back from injury quicker. You need that edge all the time. And I would have thought, I am absolutely amazed that there have been so few or even none positive tests amongst the true elite athlete. Why is that? And am I being hopelessly naive?
Well, Steve, hold on. We have had some pretty significant positives in the not too distant past. I mean, Afaway Deante is not here. Well, he was injured anyway. He wasn't going to make the South Africa squad. But this is the breakout player of the year in 2018, who's now, you know, provisionally suspended from rugby because of a positive test. Now, I did make the point in a piece I did for the Sunday Times saying, if this had happened in football, the best young player in the world had tested positive, it would have been a huge story.
Mm.
Somehow, I feel that rugby just, it's like, I don't know if it's rugby's middle class kind of roots in a way in many countries, where they don't want to kind of consider that this actually may speak to a very significant problem in South Africa.
Mm.
Because we have the positive tests from Craven Week. There have been other...
Chile by Radapelli.
Yeah, has tested positive twice or three times.
Mm.
I give tremendous credit to the South African anti-doping body that goes to Craven Week and does pretty rigorous testing, but are finding, you know, significantly, you know, high percentage of positive tests. Now, that kind of testing at schools level, it's something that we really would like to see across the rugby world, because
in Britain and Ireland,
in Britain. I mean, I gave a talk at an independent school. I remember saying at one point there was a Q&A afterwards, and this boy asked me a question about, would it not be better to treat rugby like Formula One and let people do whatever they like? They can take their drugs. I said, look, you're now 17 years of age. Let's say you're 47 and your son is going to this school. And he's been offered a contract with some premiership club. But he's told he has to get bigger. So he says, Dad, I'm going to have to take steroids. I said, what are you going to say to your son? And the 17-year-old said, I would tell him not to do it. And I said, but you've just advocated everybody being allowed to take what they... Why would you have a different set of moral values for everybody else's kids? And he kind of acknowledged that, yeah, he was wrong. And I saw four boys giggling, and they were all tall and big. And I kind of knew they were rugby players. I asked somebody afterwards, why were the boys giggling? And he said, well, we had our rugby controversy here, doping controversy. And I said, really? This kid was going away for his Easter break or his Christmas break, and he left a rucksack in his room. And out of the rucksack fell pills in a packet. And the lady who was doing the room noticed what they were. They were anabolic steroids. And this kid was on the school's team. I think he was a really decent player. And the school reported it to the RFU, and the kid got a 2-year ban. Now, that's in England. And so the one thing we can't do is get presumptuous about it. My feeling is that rugby doesn't have a significant or a huge problem.
Mm.
And the difference between rugby and, say, a sport like cycling is that all the people who are now running teams in cycling, not all of them, but most of them, were dopers themselves. They come from a doping culture. Rugby doesn't have many people who dope themselves as players and organise their doping programme. So people aren't kind of steeped in the tradition of doping.
You're saying they wouldn't know where to start, really, in terms of masking it and all that?
Yeah, and it's just not something that they would think of doing. Now, of course, a lot of the younger players now are coming through gyms. And once they go to gyms, they get exposed to people using anabolic steroids, and gyms are dangerous places for impressionable kids. And I'd be watching a lot of those, you know, schools teams very closely. I'd find a way of testing them, because the thing about testing is it does actually work. It doesn't mean that 100% of those who cheat are going to get caught. It means that it's a significant deterrent. There is a chance of getting caught. I mean, Deanti, now in Afua Deanti in South Africa, has got to deal with his situation. Mm. I mean, there was three banned substances found in his urine. That's going to take a hell of a lot of explaining. You know, it rules out a lot of, you know, if it had been one substance, you could talk about contamination.
Mm.
But three substances, you can't talk about contamination. My feeling is that if we look around all the teams in this World Cup, have some of the people been involved in some kind of doping? Some of them, small minority. Is there any country about whom you would have a suspicion? Well, what we've learned about South Africa has to make us very conscious that there could be a problem there. I think what we've learned about France is that there's a culture of over-medicalisation in France. Now, remember, Alberto Salazar's doping centre, if you want to call it, or his doping culture at the Oregon Project, that was about over-medicalisation. That's a bit what the French do. Corticosteroids for every problem you've got.
Yes.
And you can do that and get away with it for quite a long time. And I do think that rugby has been really cavalier in its use of painkillers.
Yes.
And I know that people in England would say, well, what do you mean? I mean that the drug Tramadol, it's still allowed, but it's a very serious painkiller that has the potential to be addictive. I think that's overused in English rugby. There are premiership players who use Tramadol. That's known because when the premiership players go outside of the premiership and go to other leagues, they say, where's the Tramadol? They've been used to taking Tramadol. And I don't think that's a good thing. That's just too big a painkiller to be used by sportsmen. Right. I mean, in cycling, they say that it impairs your judgment.
Does it make you play rugby when you're really not fit to?
Yes, yes, it does. Because it takes away pain, that saying to you, don't play.
Yeah.
But it also, it impairs your judgment a bit because it's an opiate, Tramadol, and it basically, you won't be quite as, you may not be as sharp. In cycling, they really don't want the riders taking it because they feel that they're more likely to crash. Now, rugby is one sport where you want to be your absolute sharpest with the extent of the physical collisions, but Tramadol is used. And that kind of medicalization really is the thin end of the wedge. You know, from there, as happened with Salazar's Oregon project, you start by messing around with thyroid drugs, and then you wonder how much testosterone could you take and still not get caught. And it's a dangerous route to go.
Just to summarise what we think about rugby, you're fairly sanguine that there's not a huge problem at the elite end, but you're also saying, honestly, even at the lower levels, you can't test enough, you can't do enough testing.
No, you can't. And the testing must go on. And I would like to think that, I know it's expensive, but there's a lot of rugby coming into, you know, certainly the English League and the French Leagues. I have a lot of, I would like to think that every player was going to be guaranteed to be tested 3 or 4 times a year.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have to be an international. You know, that any player in a first team squad who's earning a decent wage is guaranteed to be tested 3 or 4 times a season. That's not the case now. It would be good if it was. I mean, some players will get tested that amount. Someone might not get tested at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not good enough. But that deterrent needs to be there. And one of the things that rugby players should acknowledge is that they're getting away lightly in comparison to people in Olympic sports. In other words, if rugby as a 15-a-side game was an Olympic sport, all the rugby players would have to sign up to a whereabouts system. So in other words, they would be tested at home. They could be tested when they're on holidays. They could be tested on Christmas Day. They could have all of that level of testing. And that would give people like you and I more confidence that the system was robust. As it is now, they're tested at the training ground and they're tested on match days. But that's not enough. If you want a system that really gives you the best chance of deterring people from committing anti-doping offences, you have the potential to test them, you know, every single day of their lives.
David, I'll ask you one more question. Salazar, will you be taking Kate's advice?
Yeah, certainly on Nike. I think Kate's advice was absolutely right. Nike should not be allowed to get away with this. Lauren Fleshman, who was a former Nike athlete, she put out a few messages on social media last week that I thought were magnificent. She said, Nike puts its swoosh on time bombs. And when the time bombs blow up, Nike then are the last people to leave the building because they continue to support the cheats. And she said, when you put out ads, as Nike have, about the purity of sport, and then you fund the underbelly of sport that's eroding the purity, that's a problem. And that's what Nike have done. And I would love if people would seriously consider what brand they bought. In other words, do you really want to support a brand that says it believes in sport and then funds cheats? I mean, Alberto Salazar is going to take his case now to the Court of Arbitration, which he's absolutely entitled to do. Nike have a choice. Do we fund this man's case, or do we say, sorry, Alberto, you broke the rules. They're funding him.
Thank you very much, David Walsh. That was fascinating. We'd like to make 2 points clear. Afiwe Dayanti has strenuously denied taking any banned substance intentionally or negligently. And secondly, South African rugby says it tests and educates more aggressively at schoolboy level than any other federation, and that incidence of doping at senior level is in line with international norms.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.